It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we look at a campaign that is trying to get Americans to make a small dietary change to tackle some big health problems like high cholesterol and elevated blood pressure. The campaign plays to our tendency to start fresh on Mondays. It's called Meatless Monday. NPR's Allison Aubrey has the story.
Sid Lerner is a salesman who says he should be retired. He's 79, but he's no good at golf, and he still loves selling ideas. He learned the art of persuasion at the global heart of advertising.
We're now on Madison and 33rd.
Yep, Madison Avenue. He had a 50-year run as a successful ad man.
All right. My first office was a Look building, 488 Madison Avenue.
And one of the most successful campaigns he ever worked on was persuading millions of people to buy toilet paper.
Hoffmeyer, the ladies are squeezing the Charmin.
In my store, squeezing's okay, Biffle.
Charmin's so squeezably soft, it's irresistible.
Lerner has a good laugh thinking back to these commercials. Making something dull seem irresistible was a leap, but he says it's really the same challenge he's got now. You see, the concept he's trying to sell people on is Meatless Monday. This time he's using the rhythm of the week. He says Friday is payday, Saturday's play day, Sunday is pray day, but Monday, it's ripe for change. And he wants people to cut back on saturated fat by eating meatless on Mondays.
Do you want to hop in a cab at some point? Because we're going up to the 70s, right?
Yeah, right.
These days, his office is just off Madison Avenue. He started his own little nonprofit and has a few employees. They spend their days blending social media and Madison Avenue techniques to spread the word. Lerner raises money from foundations and collaborates with health experts. To make the message exciting, top chefs such as Wolfgang Puck and Mario Batali have gotten on board. Tonight, I tag along with Lerner to a swanky restaurant on the Upper West Side.
Going to Columbus and 77th, there's a restaurant there called Dovetail.
Sid's got his work cut out for him, selling Meatless Monday. At Dovetail, we find a packed dining room he'd like to convince.
How do you make moderation sexy, fun, healthy, positive, or doable, and not be a nag or a nanny?
You make the food fabulous, that's how. Dovetail is run by rising star chef John Fraser. He's backing the Meatless Monday campaign. He prepares a whole menu of meatless creations each Monday.
I just had the tempura with the curry. It was unreal, but I haven't gotten to my main course yet.
Sarah Post is here with her fiancé and another couple. The guys have ordered a microbrew beer. Sarah and her friend are having a glass of white wine, and they started their meal with chilled sweet pea soup.
I'm actually not a vegetarian at all, but I like to eat healthy, and we had friends who told us that they serve the vegetarian meals here on Monday, and we thought it was an amazing thing. It's been phenomenal.
Sid Lerner says the goal is to have people change their eating habits incrementally and not feel as if they're giving up anything. The diners here tonight, he says, are proof that going meat-free one day a week does not take people out of their comfort zones. Yet it may raise their awareness about how much animal fat they normally consume. And Sarah Post's fiancé, John Brummer, says people seem stoked about the concept.
It's an amazing new trend. It's unbelievable. It's like a little Hollywood Monday thing.
For his part, Lerner still eats meat and enjoys it, but his wake-up call came about a decade ago when his doctor told him that his cholesterol and blood pressure were way too high and that his diet was a big part of it. His father had died of heart disease, and as he looked around, he saw these lifestyle diseases everywhere. Now, meat is certainly not the only source of saturated fat, but when he researched the numbers on just how much meat Americans were really consuming, he was surprised. Back in 1950, when he was a young man, the norm was about 2.8 pounds of meat a week. Jump forward to 2006, and consumption had gone up 50% to 224 pounds of meat per person per year. Lerner says he himself was right there eating that much meat.
You know, I always think of the steaks I used to eat.
Big ribeyes or sirloins that took up two-thirds of the plate. That was the thing to order.
But I think a lot of it was status. It's like being the prettiest girl in class, and then you don't pay attention to some of the really nice people in the class who aren't as pretty. And sometimes that steak could be big and sexy and dull.
Meat is now more of a condiment in his diet, he tells me, in between bites of Chef Fraser's avocado, watercress, and tomato salad.
I love avocados, and these are delicious. It's really, really great.
But the last thing Lerner wants is for Meatless Monday to become a campaign of food elitists in New York City. So through a partnership with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, he's reached out to institutional dining facilities, from hospitals to school cafeterias. This will be the second year that some 80,000 Baltimore school kids will dine meat-free in their cafeterias on Mondays, and it's gone way beyond Baltimore.
The movement is just spreading like wildfire. I mean, not only are we reaching out to restaurants, but they're reaching out to us.
Karen Campbell directs wellness programs at Northern Kentucky University. She's brought Meatless Monday to her school and restaurants in her town. And campus dining halls from UC Davis to Yale University have come on board, too. Campbell says the interesting thing is that it's not necessarily the heart health message that motivates these college kids or young professionals. I heard that at Dovetail, too.
To be conscientious at this age about our earth and our environment is really important to us.
John Brummer says he wants to know where his meat is coming from, how is it raised, and would eating less of it be better for the earth? Environmentalist Peter Glick of the Pacific Institute says the answer to this is yes.
One of the biggest advantages of cutting back on meat consumption is the reduction in the water demand.
Glick says people are shocked when they realize how much water it takes to grow the grain needed to feed cows to produce 1 ton of beef.
It takes 140,000 bathtubs full of water. That's millions and millions of gallons. It's a lot of water, and it's certainly far more water than we think about day to day in our consumption to clean our clothes and flush our toilets and take our showers.
It's these kinds of sustainability issues that got Colleen Levine supporting Meatless Monday. She cooks meatless each Monday in her home, and she writes a mommy food blog called Foodie Tots.
I was vegetarian for a couple years in college, so I'll just eat pasta.
Starchitarian.
Exactly. Not a very healthy path to take.
This time around, with a couple of kids and a tofu-fearing husband, she has to be a lot more creative.
So I'm chopping up half a red bell pepper and some red onion.
For Meatless Monday tonight, she's doing zucchini stuffed with quinoa, peppers, and some portobello mushrooms. The whole thing takes her about 15 minutes.
No one wants to cook a big, elaborate meal on a Monday night after work, so it's a good way to kind of start the week off on a healthy note, and usually meatless meals are a little quicker to prepare as well.
As any good ad man does, Sid Lerner takes time to measure his success. He got a question put into a public opinion survey recently and found that about 20% of people had heard about the concept of Meatless Monday. But the meat industry does not think this is a trend.
I'm not so sure that it's taking off among the general population.
Janet Riley is vice president of the American Meat Institute.
It seems if you're really concerned about people's health, you'd want to have a, you know, Vegetable Tuesday or a Whole Grains Wednesday. But no, now we're telling people to give up meat, and that's just unfortunate.
Riley says she suspects that this movement is being pushed by people who care more about animal rights than human nutrition. Sid Lerner says he can't see how his one-day-a-week campaign is a threat. He does still eat meat, remember. So far, he says, he's just really surprised by how many people are paying attention. But then again, he never expected to sell so much Charmin either.
Squeezable softness. It's irresistible.
Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
And that's your health on this Monday morning.
Here's an equation for you. Drought plus wildfires in Russia minus a big stockpile of rotting wheat in India equals opportunity for American farmers and soaring grain prices around the world. Wheat prices are way up, more than 45% over the past 5 weeks. And to explain how that's playing out around the world, we're joined by Chris Hurt. He's a professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University in Indiana. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Melissa.
And Professor Hurt, let's talk first about Russia, which has just announced a ban on grain exports because of the drought and wildfires that we mentioned. How will that ripple around the globe?
Well, it is very important. Russia is the fourth largest exporter of wheat around the world in the 2009 crop. But more importantly, maybe, is to say that this isn't just Russia, but the Black Sea area. We also have the Ukraine in that area and Kazakhstan, and even some of Western Europe, where it has been abnormally warm and dry.
And who would be on the receiving end of that wheat that now may not be getting the wheat at all?
The ones that are really going to be affected, Egypt, Algeria, Nigeria, Morocco, and Iraq. So really some of the neighboring countries in Africa and on into Iran. The other thing that's really difficult for these countries is they have low incomes, generally 5 to 15% of incomes of people here in the United States. So when a basic food item like wheat goes up dramatically in price, it really affects their ability to pay for that. And of course, the pure will it be available question is another one that really makes people very worried.
And you are starting to see headlines now warning of fears of a global food crisis. And the question, could this lead to a repeat of what we saw in 2008 with food riots around the world? What do you think?
Well, I think the answer is, at this point, no. And the reasons for that are numerous. First, the world has a better inventory of basic grains and wheat. Second point is the U.S. farmers have a lot of wheat. In fact, I think they can supply the world with wheat, meeting all of that shortfall. A final thing we'll say is we can also respond. We can quickly see acreage come in the southern hemisphere, Australia and Argentina, and more acreage planted in the United States. So overall, I don't think we will repeat 2008, but certainly prices are higher.
Mm. And for context, if you were to compare the price of a bushel of wheat then and now, back at the height of the crisis, I think it was $13 a bushel. What about now?
Well, that's right, $13. We have seen wheat prices at $8. Chicago futures traded up to $8.41 on the nearby contract today. So we're dramatically different than that. We had a world booming economy in early 08. Of course, we've been through a recession. We know right now higher prices around the world maybe just can't be afforded given the more meager economy that we have today.
And what would a typical price for a bushel of wheat be?
Well, we'd been looking at closer to the $5 mark before we saw this shoot up in prices. We'll probably have to pay slightly more for food in the United States, but I don't think that's going to be substantial.
After this escalation in wheat prices that we've been talking about, we did see the prices tumble pretty sharply today with some profit-taking maybe. Do you think we've reached a peak? Have wheat prices gone as high as they'll go?
Well, that, I think, is really hard to determine. But when you see a market that trades nearly limit up as we did today in the early going, but then you see a reversal and close sharply lower, in this case today, down the limit, it often is a sign that we have put in peak prices. The reality of that will be written over the next several weeks as we see what final yields actually are.
Okay, Professor Hurt, thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Chris Hurt teaches agricultural economics at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana.
This is NPR News.
The primary cause of those fires in Russia is a severe drought that's also disrupted the grain harvest there. Russia is a huge grain exporter, and this week the country announced it will stop exporting wheat because of low yields. That decision sent wheat prices skyrocketing and has left countries like Egypt, which is the world's largest grain importer, wondering where to turn. It's a scenario that could have come right out of a new book by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus. It's called Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. And Evan Fraser joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, you have sort of connected the dots between the decline of great empires, the Roman Empire and the Mayan empires, for example, and then the collapse of their food structures. Can you explain that theory?
In every single historic case that Andrew and I were able to look at, something at some point went wrong with the food system, and the cities then no longer were able to feed themselves, and people floated away.
So what happened in Rome, for example?
Well, what happened in Rome is as the empire expanded, or the republic expanded and turned into the empire, they first of all exploited the soils and caused a lot of soil erosion, which was one of the reasons why they had to go continually expand outward in search of new soil. The second thing that they did, which was a mistake, was that they grew large and dependent on the food that they were able to obtain during a period of time when the climate was relatively nice. It was relatively easy to get good harvests. So those two combination of factors, though, didn't last. So what's called the Roman Warm Period tailed off into a fairly cool 500-600s AD in Europe. And the soil was exploited. And so those two things meant that it was very difficult to keep the surplus food out of the countryside and driven into the cities. And when that stopped, the tax revenue collapsed. It became too expensive to keep the legions going. The merchants no longer were able to move what little wares they did have into the city. And the whole system relatively quickly unraveled.
You've written that at the birth of the modern world, something went wrong with the food system. What was that?
in the modern world, we've made the same three mistakes that the Romans made and the Mayans made. And that first mistake is that we, too, have come to depend on fertile topsoil. And we have ignored the fact that the topsoil is eroding. Now, we've masked our problems with topsoil with chemical fertilizer, but that just swaps one dependency for another. The second mistake we've made is the fact that we've come to depend on harvests which we get from relatively nice climates. And the late 20th century was pretty good, generally speaking, for growing seasons, say between 1930 and 1990, there were no major climactic shocks in the world's bread baskets. Things are likely, however, to change. The third mistake we've made in the modern age, which is also echoes the historic antecedents, is that we have caused our farmers to grow economically efficient by specializing in one or two products. And while this makes wonderful economic sense, it's terrible ecology.
I mean, it's hard to imagine, certainly in developed countries, that there could ever be a kind of an Irish potato famine again. I mean, are you suggesting that something like that could happen? I mean, that we could be headed in that direction?
I don't think there will be a famine in American supermarkets anytime soon. I think that the problem is much more complicated and possibly much more insidious. So, for example, let's imagine a bad drought in northern China. Or, for example, Russia, which we're just experiencing right now. I can see that causing a country like China to suddenly buy up most of the world's rice supplies, which, given that there's not a huge amount of rice traded, wouldn't be that hard for a country like China to do that. So if China starts buying up a lot of wheat and a lot of rice, then I can imagine, say, countries like the Philippines or Thailand, which normally export to, say, the Middle East or East Africa, suddenly stopping selling to those markets and selling to China. I can then that see causing a major subsistence crisis linked with increased food inflation in already politically volatile parts of the world, and that setting off urban migration, migration across national borders, and increased disease threats as poor, hungry, malnourished people start coming in contact with each other and moving long distances. And then that starts creating a cascading effect. And the ensuing hysteria, political hysteria, could then cause a very, very serious problem for the global food system.
Is there a country that is doing it right today? I mean, is there a sort of a model, I guess, food empire out there right now?
At the country level, most of us are completely invested in this global food system, which is built on some very, very rickety pillars. I think, however, there's a lot of interesting stuff that goes on more at a municipal level with farmers markets, community-supported agriculture, with food policy councils, which are springing up all over cities and towns in Canada and in the U.S. And these are really talking about trying to shorten supply chains, create a level of food sovereignty at a local level, invest in things like soup kitchens and community kitchens, which act as an insurance policy against food shocks for economically poor people. So I think the most innovative stuff is actually happening at a small scale across North America. And there's very little attention to this issue being placed at a national or international scale.
That's Evan Fraser. He teaches geography at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and he's the co-author of the book Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Evan Fraser, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Pop-Tarts have taken their place in haute cuisine.
Pop-Tarts, you can eat them hot or cold, eat them a la mode.
The makers of the breakfast food opened a store and restaurant in Times Square. The New York Times did an in-depth investigation. The menu includes the Fluffer Butter, marshmallow spread between two Pop-Tarts pastries. And then there's Pop-Tarts Sushi, in which they are minced and wrapped in a fruit roll-up. It's Morning Edition.